From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The clock is ticking on the deadline set for the White House to produce evidence, any evidence, that the Obama administration wiretapped phones at Trump Tower last year. The ranking members of the House Intelligence Committee, Republican Devin Nunes and the Democrat Adam Schiff, signed a letter last week asking the Justice Department for evidence by today. Then there's that looming report on the Republican health care plan, and the president is expected to unveil his budget this week. And so NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro has been a busy guy. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And what are you expecting today with this evidence deadline?
Well, Dana Bente, who's the acting attorney general, essentially, in this kind of situation, because Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, recused himself from any investigations dealing with Trump, has to the end of the day to provide Congress with evidence of any applications for, FISA court application or any of that, which would allow them to have done any kind of wiretapping. It's unclear what any kind of enforcement would be if nothing is provided. It certainly would discredit the theory if they don't provide anything. And it likely means Congress wouldn't pick up any sort of investigation. You wonder if it then points in the direction back at President Trump, but I'm not sure what that would be.
Well, yesterday, the president's top spokesperson, Kellyanne Conway, talked to the Bergen Record in New Jersey and seemed to be picking up on those CIA documents that were hacked by WikiLeaks. Because when she was asked about the wiretap, she said there was the possibility of surveillance by TVs, even microwaves. Of course, the CIA may have used those tools, but they're not allowed to use them domestically. But anyway, she was asked today about those claims that she made about microwaves in that fiery interview with CNN's Chris Cuomo earlier today. Here is her response.
I'm not Inspector Gadget. I don't believe people are using the microwave to spy on the Trump campaign. However, I'm not in the job of having evidence. That's what investigations are for.
To which Chris Cuomo responded, well, the president can pick up the phone and find out. What's going on here?
Well, look, I think this is about the president believing that these things are true and not necessarily there being evidence for it, as we've heard Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, say. And what always winds up happening is that these folks in the White House and advising the White House are doubling down. Whether it's Trump, whether it's Conway, whether it's Spicer, they don't really give in and say, you know what, you guys are right. There's nothing to this. So let's just do away with it, move on to something else. They will continue to double down and spin their way out of it, although it's getting kind of difficult to follow where they're heading
right.
at this point.
And it keeps it alive. Look, the Congressional Budget Office is expected to have their analysis of the Republican health plan tomorrow. Republicans on the offense yesterday, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan on CBS's Face the Nation.
What we are trying to achieve here is bringing down the cost of care, bringing down the cost of insurance, not through government mandates and monopolies, but by having more choice and competition. And by lowering the cost of health care, you improve the access to health care.
Now, Domenico, what was key is he went on to say, so if there are fewer people covered, and it's anticipated that's what the CBO is going to say, it's because those people choose it, you know, because they don't have a mandate, almost saying it's their fault. Not ours. You know, it's their choice. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that the Republican idea here is to incentivize rather than force people to buy it, even though the mandate was a Republican idea in the first place. And there is a bit of a stick in this bill, but not quite as strong as the mandate would be. So it's more of a carrot rather than a stick to provide people with those refundable tax credits. But still, when that CBO score comes out, it's going to be a big deal. Mm-hmm. If you are covered and it costs more, it certainly undermines their talking points.
Yeah, the president expected to release his federal budget later this week. Seems to be he's going to increase defense spending, significantly cut other parts. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, increase military spending, decrease domestic discretionary spending. That is something that's going to be – it's going to lay out what the domestic priorities politically are for this president, because really these budgets that a president releases are not much more than political documents, because Congress are the ones who appropriate funds.
Yeah. Look, we have to ask you. Iowa Representative Stephen King tweeted this weekend. His tweet read, "We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies." Now, this was a tweet in support of the Dutch politician who's so strongly against any immigration. White supremacist David Duke tweeted out in support of Stephen King's tweet. You know, yeah. What does this do for the current climate? I mean, ordinarily you'd see a White House disown that kind of a tweet. I mean, what happens now because of that?
Yeah, I think the White House would disown this kind of tweet. But, you know, at the same time, you flirt with folks like this on the right who want to support him. It's hard to see it in any other way than something that's a racist tweet or a racist comment. I mean, he said that he meant exactly what he said. Yeah. He said, I'd like to see an America that's just so homogenous that we look a lot the same from that perspective. So given that, you know, it's a very difficult thing for any White House to defend, and I would expect them to separate themselves with it, at least in speech.
Yeah, to be clear, he said he did not walk it back today. He said, I think we need more whites. And boy, some people are drawing the line from that kind of remark and that kind of a tweet directly to the White House and Donald Trump's comments about immigration. So it'll be interesting to see how they react to that. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, no lack of things to take a look at. Domenico, thank you.
Certainly not. Thank you so much.
Each day in the United States, there are approximately 20,000 juveniles held in detention facilities. The average length of stay is about 20 days. That may not seem like much, but research shows that even a short time behind bars can have a major impact on these young people. In Arizona, juveniles are often held in adult jail for months and sometimes even years while they await trial. Jimmy Jenkins from Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports.
When Dallas Wyatt was just 16 years old, he was charged with a serious crime, a drive-by shooting. Police took him out of school and put him in jail.
As a young person, I thought coming to jail would just be, you know, just sitting around for a couple months and they let me go. Now I've been sitting around almost for a couple years now, and that's not the case.
It's been almost 2 years, and Wyatt is still waiting to stand trial. He spent most of his time behind bars at a jail for adults called the Lower Buckeye Jail. Juvenile offenders like Wyatt, who are charged as adults, are detained there in a separate section of the jail.
We refer to this as a podular remote type of a housing system. As you can see, we have a control tower. We have officers that every 25 minutes make rounds in and walk through the housing unit.
Chief Deputy Brian Lee is responsible for the oversight of several jails in Maricopa County. We're standing in the day room at Lower Buckeye, an open area surrounded by two floors of tiny two-man cells. There's nothing juvenile about it. It's a jail, sparse, dirty, gray, and pretty bleak. Down a long corridor in the juvenile classroom, it's a slightly different scene. Young offenders are sitting at computers beneath faux windows painted with a mountain skyline. They type with one hand as they work on continuing education programs. Their other hand is chained to the desk. There are, on average, about 70 juveniles held in the Lower Buckeye Jail on a daily basis. They're 15 to 17 years old, mostly male and mostly Hispanic. When juveniles are housed in an adult jail like this, they aren't supposed to be able to hear or see adult offenders. Chief Lee says his staff does the best they can to ensure that separation.
We have one medical clinic here. We have, you know, certain parts of the facility that we have to get juveniles into, and then we need to get adults into. So it poses quite the challenge.
While he was imprisoned at Lower Buckeye, Dallas Wyatt says he always felt safe, but he did come into contact with adult offenders.
It's most of the time they try to speak to us. Oh, what are you in for? You know, what's your name or something like that.
The separation policy is referred to as sight and sound, and it's federally mandated by the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. Beth Rosenberg with the Children's Action Alliance says the intent of the law is to protect impressionable young minds.
Youth are not little adults. They are actually youth whose brains are developing, and I think that any adult contact with them influences their behavior or could influence their behavior.
These kids don't have any role models, you know, or any real support. So if you see somebody who looks cool or is nice to you or seems like he's wise, you're going to want to follow that type of advice.
As a public defender, attorney Mike Traer Jr. represented several juveniles held at the Lower Buckeye Jail. He says being a kid housed in an adult facility puts children at risk.
I think they feel like they need to be more grown up and tougher, and they put on a layer of this type of toughness, but they're scared kids.
Traer says he'd much rather see his juvenile clients held in a juvenile jail.
There's more human interaction. I think there's greater interaction with family members. It's not as dreadful. It's different than the Lower Buckeye Jail.
Arizona law prevents juveniles charged as adults with a violent felony offense from being jailed in a juvenile facility. But Beth Rosenberg with the Children's Action Alliance says courts should be given more discretion to keep juveniles awaiting trial out of adult jails.
And certainly if kids could be held in the juvenile detention facility, that is a more appropriate facility because it's different interactions you need to have with those kids and different programming.
There seems to be some willingness in Maricopa County to review the incarceration policy. Newly elected Sheriff Paul Pinzone says he's been in talks with several state Supreme Court justices about juvenile detention as he explores the issue.
I think the best answers come from truly doing the research and knowing what you're speaking about and best practices. I'm not there yet, but we must ensure the safety of anyone who's within our custody.
Dallas Wyatt hopes he will soon be able to finally stand trial for the crime he says he did not commit. He says his time behind bars has transformed him.
I learned a lot about patience. I learned a lot about life. And just coming from being a little boy to a man, becoming a man.
He says when you grow up in jail, you grow up quick. For Here and Now, I'm Jimmy Jenkins in Phoenix.
Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and he's got a new book out. It's called The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Tom Nichols is worried. To get a better sense about what he's worrying about, listen to this excerpt. Quote, I fear we are moving beyond a natural skepticism regarding expert claims to the death of the ideal of expertise itself, a Google-fueled, Wikipedia-based, blog-sodden collapse of any division between professionals and laypeople, teachers and students, knowers and wanderers. In other words, between those with achievement in an area and those with none. Whoa. Well, I recently spoke with Nichols, and I asked him if it's really that bad.
There's always been some tension between the ordinary citizen and, you know, intellectuals or pointy heads or professionals or people with a lot of achievement in a particular area. What's different now is that people are not just skeptical about professionals. They believe themselves to be their peers, that they will actually lecture experts in a particular field. My own background in Russia and foreign affairs, you know, people literally, and this predates the internet. I mean, this goes back some time. I think it's not that new a phenomenon in American life. But what is new is people saying, you know a lot about Russia? Well, let me explain Russia to you. Hmm. Or a doctor. Well, you're a doctor? Let me explain what I know about surgery to you. And that's different. And the word I use throughout the book is narcissism. The thing that has really fueled this death of expertise problem is a growing narcissism in the American public among a people who believe that they are that they can't never get anything wrong, that they can never be told they're wrong, and have a very thin skin about ever being corrected or told that someone else might know more than they do.
Right. And so, just to be clear, when we say death of expertise, what you're really talking about is the death in the trust or belief in the value of expertise.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but I'm curious about this question of why the narcissism, to use your phrase, seems to be at a peak, or maybe not a peak, but surging now. I mean, should we look to the internet and the echo chamber that the internet can form or easily becomes as fuel for that?
The internet and cable television in particular have become enablers or energizers for this kind of narcissism because we are inclined, because of those technological achievements, to spend less and less time with each other. And the more time you spend alone and the more time you spend only listening to views you agree with, the more brittle and narcissistic you become. But I think it does predate this, and I think some of it is a disease of affluence. I think some of it is a disease of prosperity.
Meaning what? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, for example, looking around at the level, the standard of living the average American has, I always find it remarkable when people say, well, you know, the experts have done nothing for us. And, you know, this is the word younger students will sometimes say to me, Professor, you don't understand. This is the worst time ever. And
In their lives,
exactly. And, you know, I look back, I'm not an old man, but I've lived through some worse times than what we're living through now. And I think at that point, you look for somebody to blame. And I'm very concerned that this dovetails with our politics, that we're all about scapegoating and finding excuses for, you know, our own problems, and experts who are always far away and nobody you happen to know personally always make for a good people to blame, always make for a good scapegoat in that situation.
So in your book, you point out that one of the things about the internet and social media is that it allows people to confuse the ease with which they can collect facts with actual expertise.
Yeah, the metaphor that I use in the book is people who think they're smart after surfing the web for a long time are like people who feel like they're good swimmers because they got wet walking through a rainstorm. Simply letting facts wash over you with dozens and dozens of mouse clicks is not the same thing as learning anything. And it's actually quite disturbing to find that now educators and psychologists are looking into this and finding that, in fact, clicking through stories and blowing through web pages can actually make you stupider than when you started, that you will actually know less because the things you do know are more likely to be wrong. Because you have no way to discriminate between good information and bad information, especially at the speed of rapid clicking through pages.
So I do want to talk in a moment about your fears for democracy here. But let me push back for a second and say that if indeed there is this collective distrust of expertise right now in amongst the American people, that maybe they have reason. They have reason to feel a profound sense of distrust. I mean, here's a small list. None of these are going to come as a surprise to you. The Iraq War. Let's reach back a little further. Gulf of Tonkin. Let's reach back a little further. What is it? 40 years of experiments on African American men with the Tuskegee experiments being lied to by people in white coats. Okay, let's move forward in time. 2008, the financial crisis, predatory lending, so-called experts in the world of finance saying we're going to make the economy go gangbusters when instead they just dropped a nuclear bomb into the middle of it. Of course people are going to distrust experts.
Well, there's a whole chapter in the book on when the experts are wrong. And I talk about not just bad calls, but also the problem, you know, one that you didn't bring up, with falsification, plagiarism, fraud. I mean, experts are human beings. You know, there are lousy airline pilots in the world who have crashed airplanes. But nonetheless, you still trust pilots to fly the plane rather than your Aunt Rose. Unless she's a pilot.
But what I'm getting at is that I feel like there has been a cascade of systemic failures that people are sensitive to.
But what the public calls failures, there's a problem here because in many of these cases, the public calls these failures because they don't want to remember their own part in it. With the 2003 Gulf War, for example, it's easy to forget that academic international relations experts took out a full page ad. Now, I was not one of them. But my colleagues out there took out a full page ad in the New York Times saying this is a bad idea. It's only in retrospect that the populist answer is, well, we were all against it. And, well, the fact of the matter is we weren't all against it. And George Bush was reelected in 2004. People have brought up Vietnam.
But wait. Hang on. One one-page ad in the New York Times does not balance out an onslaught of national security experts saying there are WMD in Iraq. I mean, these are people that people are supposed to trust.
I mean, first of all, I was
or intelligence from the intelligence office.
I was one of the people involved in that public debate, and I made a bad call because I thought Saddam Hussein was acting like he had WMD. The question is, were these experts – first of all, the most important thing is there was not a consensus of expert opinion that people are now retroactively pointing to saying all you experts told us. There were fierce arguments among experts. There were blood on the floor arguments about experts. And my point is we were all trying to do our best to get to the truth. And I think for every expert failure, you have to first understand that it's very rare that that failure was the product of a consensus, although the last election in polling is a good example where all the experts were like, oh, we're all pretty sure how this is going to go, and they were all surprised. Do those expert communities try to correct themselves? Are they more right than wrong? Because this is something I bring up in the book. I don't say that experts are always right or that you should trust them unquestioningly. I simply say they're more likely to be right than a layperson. And I think that's an important distinction.
Is another part of the problem here what feels like, and whether it's true or not, what feels like a decoupling of the world of expertise from the experience of everyday people? And here's what I mean. Like, for example, you know, every time we talk about numbers like GDP or the rate of growth of the economy or wages or whatever, we kind of talk about them in macro terms and we're like, hey, GDP went up 2% or whatever. But there are people who on the ground are saying, well, that's great, except in reality, I haven't seen any difference in my life whatsoever. So we're awash in a world of expertise that's almost out of context for individuals.
But there's a couple of problems there. One is, and for this I put the blame squarely on the shoulders of the ordinary citizen. if you really want to be connected to that kind of expertise and understand it better, people have to do a better job of keeping themselves informed. But it is amazing, and I talk about these incidents in the book, people who have very strong opinions about what we should do in Ukraine and have no idea where Ukraine is. The other problem is I think, increasingly unreasonable expectations of what experts can do or what expertise can accomplish. Because the kind of thing you're talking about is a confirmation bias problem, right? I mean, I was here in Boston years ago when we were actually undergoing a labor shortage. I remember fast food restaurants saying, we'll pay you to ride the bus. We'll pay you for the time you leave the house to come work for us because we'd had such a tight labor market in Boston. But that doesn't help the one guy who is always going to step forward and say, well, that's all great news, but I don't have a job.
Yeah.
And therefore, everybody's wrong. That's a classic problem of confirmation bias. People have a tendency, and it is that, as we were talking about earlier, it's that normal human tendency to say, whatever is happening to me is the world. And I think experts our job is to dispassionately push back against that to say, there is a bigger picture, there are bigger things to think about, not everything is about you.
Do you think, really, or maybe in amongst all this darkness in this conversation, is there's a candle of hope that we have been through periods of time before where, again, back where we started, where there was rising anti-intellectual, but the Republic survived.
Yes. Well, let me take a let me say one positive thing, but then and say that, yes, the Republic, I have a great amount of faith in the enduring ability of our institutions, but I'm very concerned that sometimes it takes a crisis or something terrible before people understand the importance of expert knowledge. People don't want to talk to doctors until their fever hits 102, and then they rediscover the importance of medical expertise. So I'm hoping we can do something before that happens.
Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. His new book is titled The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Would love to have you back sometime soon.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Now, there's more to this conversation at our website, including an explanation of the Dunning-Kruger effect. That's the one where the less you know, the more you think you know. That's at hereandnow.org.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. So we know you like podcasts because you're listening to one, but all this month we want to ask you to go a step further and share the love. Find someone who has never downloaded a podcast or maybe someone who doesn't even know they exist and tell them about one that they'll enjoy. You'll be opening up an entirely new world to them. Whether it's this podcast or another, we'd love to know what you are recommending. So tell us with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
Your credit score may soon be improving, and not because of anything that you do. The three main credit reporting firms have decided to leave certain negative information off of credit reports. FICO projects that the changes could boost credit scores for millions of Americans. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her new podcast is Better Off. Hi there, Jill.
Hello.
So speaking of better off, how is it that Americans are going to be better off with their credit scores all of a sudden?
Remember, the credit reporting agencies are the one that gather all the information. They send it off to FICO, to Fair Isaac, a company, and that's how your score is derived. Well, these three credit agencies have decided that many, not all, tax liens and civil judgments will be purged from your credit reports. And that's kind of cool because that's the kind of negative information that can really ding people and it can stick around your credit report for a long time. So if it's not included, it stands to help about 12 million Americans.
Wow.
So it's not an insignificant amount of people.
A lot of people. So tax liens and civil judgments. And are they doing this because they've determined that these two pieces of information don't actually, you know, correlate well with one's creditworthiness? Or is there some other reason why they're making this change?
Yeah, you know, I always feel like the credit agencies, the reporting agencies, the scoring agencies of all types, they're not exactly the best human beings in the
world.
I'm sorry to say that to my friends in that business. But, you know, the thing is that this has really been an ongoing process because if you recall, a few years back, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau had done a big report as to what really drove people crazy about their credit records. And then one of the big things was that, number one, there was a lot of incorrect information on these records. Number two, it was really hard to get the incorrect information off. And number three, that sometimes bad luck things stuck around your record for so long, and it really hurt your ability to maybe get a mortgage or, in some cases, get a job. So there's been an effort by the states individually, and there were some settlements recently. This was prompting the credit reporting firms to pull out some of this negative information. This is part of this, this non-loan related stuff that can really hurt you. I mean, there used to be some things there about library fines. Come on, really? Library fines?
I would be in big trouble, to be perfectly honest. Hopefully no one from my local library is listening to this. But so these changes are they're set to take effect in July. Does that mean all of a sudden we're going to have 12 million people have brighter prospects for, you know, getting a loan or a mortgage? Or do you think lenders might change, you know, sort of how they look at the credit score?
Well, there's a couple of things. Number one, we're not talking about you going from 600 to 800 on your credit score. Remember, it's 300 to 850 is how the range goes. But, you know, maybe 20 points for most people, that would be a change. And frankly, it might actually be more significant, not so much this particular instance, but this idea that because of these settlements, because of a consumer pushback around removing incorrect information, that credit scores could become more accurate. Now, the other side of this is that, hey, you know what? If you've got a tax lien that's on your record, maybe you are a bad credit risk. Mm. There's some fear around that among credit experts. But by and large, I think the biggest issue that we have to take a look at is don't forget to check your credit report. It's annualcreditreport.com once a year for
yep.
free.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thanks so much.
Take care.
And now one of those stories that makes you think, what have I done lately? For more than a decade, 59-year-old Benedictine monk Father Columbus Stewart has been traveling to some of the world's most dangerous places to help locals photograph about 140,000 ancient manuscripts, about 50 million pages in all. And with the rise of ISIS, his work has become even more urgent and risky. Father Stewart is the director of the nonprofit Hill Museum and Manuscript Library based at St. John's Abbey and University in Collegeville, Minnesota. We came across his work in a recent article in The Atlantic. Father Columba, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So tell us about some of these manuscripts. What do they look like? What do they say?
Oh, they look like every possible thing. We've worked with manuscripts as various as palm leaf archival material in India to beautiful illuminated manuscripts that we found in Iraq.
Illuminated? What does that mean?
So beautiful illustrations, which tell you something about the culture, not only in terms of how they interpret a story, say, from the Bible, but also how they view the world and how they depict reality in their art. So a lot of the manuscripts are pretty unremarkable. They're simply a way of preserving a text. So the average person may look at it and say, well, I expected a Book of Hours or something with lots of gold. But to the scholar, of course, these things can be gold because it might be the only copy of a text that's otherwise lost, or a translation of a text from another language, which tells you something about how ideas and writings flow from one culture to another. So you really never know what you're going to find until somebody takes the time to read it.
What are some of the things that made you say, I cannot believe I'm seeing this?
So here's an example. There's a history of the world that was preserved in a 15th century manuscript. The text actually dates from the 12th century, but the only copy we have of it in the original Syriac language was a 15th century manuscript. And that manuscript was in southeast Turkey, and it was taken from Turkey to Syria in 1923 when the Christian population of a certain city had to leave, and they went to Aleppo for safety. That manuscript tells the story of Christians in the Middle East and what happened to them when the Crusaders arrived from Europe to liberate the Holy Land and to claim it back for Christians. And, of course, it was the local Christians who took the heat in response. So we read that kind of story, and it makes us look at some of the current events perhaps with different eyes.
And there's always been a threat that these kinds of documents, rare manuscripts, will be destroyed. But that's been increasing in the last decade and a half because of the rise of militant groups and, of course, ISIS. Do you feel that pressure?
We feel that pressure all the time. We started the current round of our work around the time that I became the director in 2003, working in Lebanon. So we've seen the dissolution of the Middle East, as it has been known now for decades, just in the time that we've been working. And the work we're currently doing in Mali in West Africa with the manuscripts of Timbuktu is another place which experienced a very sudden dislocation with the appearance of a kind of Islamist and nationalist uprising in the north of Mali and the evacuation of manuscripts. None of these things could have been foreseen. So in a way, it was really extraordinarily providential that we were working where we were, or that there were people on the ground who belonged to these cultures who had the foresight to move things before it was too late.
Yeah. So here you go, trying to train locals to do the photography. Why don't you ask to do some of it?
A lot of these communities have long memories, and they remember what happened in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries when Europeans came and took their manuscripts, and that's what makes the great manuscript libraries of Europe now. So they are often rightfully suspicious toward the foreigner who shows up with an interest in their manuscript heritage. So we're trying to do it a different way. We're trying to bring our expertise to these local communities so that they have the privilege and also a paying job of working to preserve their own cultural heritage.
But then even after they've been photographed, many have been destroyed. Now, I'm just imagining you must have tremendous mixed emotions. You just relief that they had been photographed. But these aren't the same as the pieces of parchment that were held by hands hundreds of years ago.
So I suppose the analogy, not to overdramatize, would be looking at a photograph of a loved one who's no longer with us. The picture is precious. It's a reminder, but it obviously is only a stand-in for the person. And the same is true even of high-quality digital images. They're great for scholars to work with. But a manuscript not only has a kind of almost sacred power when you hold it, but there are also things about the physical object that it will only tell you if you hold it in your hand. You get a better sense of how it's actually put together. You have a closer encounter with the binding structure. You can examine more closely the fabrics or papers or old leaves of manuscripts that they've used to hold the manuscript together. And then there's also the value of seeing a manuscript as part of a collection or a library.
And where are some of these, by the way?
You find them in monasteries. You'll find them in churches. In some cases, they are family libraries, which have been kept often for centuries because there was a scholar at some point in the history of the family, and they've kept them, as is true of some of the Muslim families we've worked with in Jerusalem. Sometimes they're hidden deliberately behind a false bookcase, and then there's a secret door, and beyond that is a marvelous room full of manuscripts. So we've really seen just about every possible form of storage.
So how do you convince people who, as you said, might be hesitant about somebody coming from the West to see their sacred manuscripts? How do you convince them to do this?
Well, you don't make a cold call. First of all, we try to learn where there might be important manuscript collections that need to be preserved, either because they might be in danger or because they're so important that scholars really want to see them. So then we try to figure out who could be an introducer or an influencer, a member of that community, maybe a scholar who is trusted by them, and that's the bridge. And then I'll go and meet them and try to establish my own personal relationship with them.
Who are some of these people? Who are you meeting?
Sometimes it's a member of a family. In the case of these libraries in Jerusalem, they are the current generation of these very ancient and prominent families. In other cases, it might be a more remote location, and you're working with a monk or a bishop or a local person who hasn't traveled extensively, may not know a lot of foreigners. You're working through an interpreter. But in every instance, it's a matter of their being convinced that we respect them, even if we don't understand or know everything about their culture, and that we are not in it for any kind of personal profit.
Yeah. Does it help that you're a Benedictine monk?
You know, it does help a lot. So with Eastern Christians, if they see me turning up in my black Benedictine habit, that signifies. And it sort of softens the fact that I come as a representative of the United States, which is not always the card to lead with in some of these places. With Muslims, I think there's also a deep respect for people whom they view as having a commitment to a religious tradition. And they understand that Benedictines have a tradition of learning. We're known as being people who throughout the Middle Ages kept copying manuscripts. And even in the modern era, we're very much involved in the beginnings of modern manuscript studies. And somehow that aspect of what you might call the Benedictine brand is very widely diffused. And it's sometimes recognized in the most unexpected places.
Do you ever find yourself wondering as you are, you know, walking a long road towards the next place where you're going to try to convince someone? Do you ever start thinking, what am I doing?
You know, I don't. The founder of our project, Father Oliver, in the 1960s, went from monastery to monastery in an Austrian winter trying to find one abbot who was willing to let these Americans come and microfilm their manuscripts. So when I get a little tired or weary, I think of Father Oliver trudging through the snow from big monastery to big monastery. And he had no idea what the future would bring if there'd be war again in Europe, but he had a sense that this is what we should be doing. And I have that same sense. And I think we've learned since 2003 that you never know when the next thing might happen. Syria is a good example. Everyone told us when we started working there in 2004 it was the most secure and safe country in the Middle East. And look what happened.
Yeah. Father Columba Stewart, a Benedictine monk and director of the not-for-profit Hill Museum and Manuscript Library based at St. John's Abbey and University in Collegeville, Minnesota. 50 million pages of manuscripts have been photographed because of his efforts. Father Stewart, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And this note, last week in the battle over Mosul in Iraq, ISIS burned the Antiquities Museum, hundreds of rare books and manuscripts reduced to ash. For more on Father Stewart's nonprofit, go to hearandnow.org.
A diplomatic spat between Turkey and the Netherlands has inflamed tensions over immigration just days before the Dutch elections, in which the party of populist Geert Wilders hopes to make major gains. The Dutch government blocked two Turkish foreign ministers from attending rallies in the Netherlands this weekend, sparking protests across Rotterdam and Istanbul. "Go away and never come back," Geert Wilders tweeted, "and take all your Turkish fans from the Netherlands with you, please," end quote. One Turkish minister responded by accusing the Dutch of, quote, fascism. For more, we're joined now by Gerrit Voerman, a professor at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And Professor, break this down for us. How did this incident start exactly?
The Minister of Foreign Affairs wanted to come to the Netherlands to campaign for a yes vote in the referendum, which will be taking place in April in Turkey, which is aimed to extend the powers of the President Erdogan. And the Dutch government was not very in favor of this. So when the Minister of Foreign Affairs wanted to come last Saturday, he was forbidden to come to the Netherlands. And then later, the Minister of Family Affairs came by car, and she was stopped near the Turkish consulate in Rotterdam. And then the whole affair started to escalate.
I see. Now, folks in America may be wondering why Turkish ministers would even come to the Netherlands for a Turkish referendum, but that's because there are several hundred thousand Dutch residents who are of Turkish origin, and do they have the right to vote in Turkish elections?
Indeed, they have. And this happens every time when there are national elections in Turkey. Dutchmen with a Turkish background, they can vote in the Turkish national elections, but also in the referendum. And there are nearly 500,000 people with a Turkish background living here. So it's an interesting electoral market for Erdogan. Mm.
Now, of course, this is of particular interest because the Netherlands is undergoing its own election. As we mentioned a little earlier, Geert Wilders tweeted out, "Go away and never come back, and take all your Turkish fans from the Netherlands with you, please." How did what happen? Is that likely to help Wilders or not in his campaign for prime minister?
I think it will help Wilders, although I don't think he will become prime minister because none of the other parties is willing to participate with him in a government. So he will be excluded from a government, even if he becomes the largest party Wednesday. But I think it will improve his position in the in the election campaign. Because up till now, there was not a clear theme dominating in the campaign, and it had to do with the fact that there was not a clear race between two parties which wanted to become the largest one. Usually we have such a situation. Such a race, such a dynamic does not take place. There are more or less four or five parties who can still hope to become the largest party on Wednesday. And the content of the election campaign is quite diverse. Uh-huh. There are not clear items which are dominating. But now, after the clash with Turkey, national identity and the problems with Islamic immigrants and so on, I think it will become dominant in the campaign.
So Wilders' party is the Party for Freedom. Are you saying that there's a possibility that the party may emerge victorious?
There's a possibility, yes, although it seems that the party is declining in the polls. It was quite strong in 2015 during the refugee crisis. It started to decline in 2016. After the election of Trump, the party improved again in the polls. But at the beginning of this year, the party started to decline again. So it seems to be a kind of connection with the election of Trump and the problems the Trump administration faced quite early in this year. And now the party is still declining, and it's in the polls, according to the polls, it's the second party, and the first party is the party of Prime Minister Rutte, the Conservative Liberal Party.
Mm. You know, it's interesting because this election in the Netherlands, of course, is coming at a time where you mentioned President Donald Trump. We had a surge of nativist populism here in the United States. People are also looking to France right now and whether or not Marine Le Pen has the possibility of winning there. So can you put what's happening in the Netherlands in a broader context for us? I mean, is even the fact that Wilders party, the Party for Freedom, is potentially viable, is that mark a change in the politics in the Netherlands?
I think the effects of a victory of the Freedom Party at the coming election in the Netherlands will be relatively small, because the Dutch political system is based on coalitions. And even if Wilders becomes the largest party, he might take the initiative in the formation of a new government. But all the other parties will say no to him. So after this first round in the formation of a new government, Wilders will remain with empty hands. And then Rutte, if he becomes second largest party, then the chance is for Rutte to create a new government without the Freedom Party and with, well, four, perhaps five other parties.
Hmm, interesting. Gerrit Voorman is a professor at the University of Groningen. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Linguistica 360 with news in slow Spanish, news in slow French, and news in slow Italian programs. Weekly language learning shows with discussion of current events. More at newsinslow.com. News in slow, language learning through current events.